Welcome to Political Rewind on a rainy Wednesday here in Atlanta. I guess we're starting to see the most outer fringes of Hurricane Harvey, which has done so much terrible damage in the state of Texas. We'll talk a little bit about the president's response to the crisis that they're dealing with down there. And we have a lot, of course, news, as always, to discuss here today. Want to start with some state headlines, though. And to do that, we have Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You know, Greg, you said something as we were waiting to go on the air. You said, there's a story I want to write if I have time to do it. You always have you always have time to write like 5-6 stories a day. I
mean, it has been very busy lately, even with the absence of the 6th district race and impending elections in the state, not till next year. But still, it just seems like it never stops.
Yeah, and we have a mayor's race that we'll all be following here in Atlanta, of course. I know you're not the lead political reporter on it, but certainly there's going to be, I assume you're going to at some point involved in writing about that. Loretta Lepore is with us again. It's been too long. We're glad to have you
back. Thank you. I'm glad to be here today.
Loretta, of course, is a longtime Republican strategist. She served in the administration of Sonny Perdue when he was governor, back as his communications director.
Press secretary.
Okay, sorry. That's... We don't like, those of us in broadcasting, we don't like that term, press secretary.
Oh, okay.
but I get that. Okay. And, of course, she was the co-chair of Carly Fiorina's presidential run here in Georgia in 2016. And she does government affairs work, lobbying, mostly her expertise on transportation is something we always like to tap when we're talking about that issue. And we have a new member of our panel who we're really glad to have here, Jocelyn Butler Baker, who you have served across the aisle. You worked in Governor Barnes' administration back in the late 1990s.
And Governor Miller's before that.
And Governor Miller before that, when you were just a kid.
Maybe.
Then you went to work for Republican Senator Johnny Isaacson. So you've really had an experience across the aisle.
I did. I had the opportunity to work with Senator Isaacson, his first run for the Senate in 1996, and enjoyed getting to know him in that experience, and have been glad to be able to get to know people across the spectrum here in Georgia.
And now you, too, have your own firm that does government relations work. I think it's fair to call it that.
I think it's fair to call it that.
Yeah. All right. Well, welcome. We're glad to have you here,
Jocelyn. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let's get started on a story. You know, Greg, on Monday, in the hours following the unveiling of the that beautiful statue of Dr. King.
What a moment that was.
It was an incredible moment.
I know
you've
talked about it, but it was just a great...
Yeah, day. And, well, we can talk more about it, but, you know, we devoted the entire show to that day. And what I said at the time was, I said two things. I said, number one, it's so great to have an event that we can talk about, a positive political event, an event that brought people together. We didn't talk about President Trump at all and the divisiveness in the country over him. We focused on that extraordinary moment when the statue was unveiled. But I also said, let's not kid ourselves, this kumbaya moment is not going to last. This is still Georgia. And here comes Representative Jason Spencer in a fight with a white South Georgia state rep, in a fight with an African-American representative, LaDawn Jones. Talk to us, because you filed this piece. What did Jason Spencer on a Facebook post say to Representative Jones?
Yeah, and the quick backstory is Representative Spencer and Representative Jones have been seatmates for 4 years between 2012 and 2016 in the Georgia House. So they had a friendly, if sometimes testy, relationship where they'd kind of banter back and forth either on social media or in person about policies. Well, he put up a picture of a Jefferson Davis site down in South Georgia, basically saying he's going to support it no matter what. They can't take this away from us in terms of the ongoing debate about Civil War monuments. And she responded how, you know, enjoy it while it lasts, because one day, you know, there's going to be a movement to get rid of all these remaining Civil War sites. These are symbols of hate and divisiveness, is her argument. And essentially over the next I don't know, a few hours in back and forth Facebook posts, Representative Spencer warned her that don't go around the South Georgia espousing these views, or in his words, you could go missing in the Okefenokee. He said at one other point,
he said, you won't be met with torches, but something a lot more definitive if she continues to try to remove Confederate memorials.
He also said people in South Georgia are people of action, not drama, and too many necks, they are red around here. Don't say I didn't warn you about them. Now, I called both lawmakers after this, and Jason Spencer asked essentially if I could just, if I wrote the story, if I could put the entire Facebook dialogue they had out, which I put in the story, and he said that his words were not meant as a threat, but a warning to her of how people can behave about this issue. She's from Atlanta, he said, and the rest of Georgia sees this issue very differently. Just trying to keep her safe if she decided to come down and raise a heck about the memorial in the backyard to folks who see this as an unwelcome aggression from the left.
All right, so Jocelyn, you actually sent me an article from Georgia Powell, right?
Yes.
Which makes the point that these two have these friendly but contentious back and forths all the time. We shouldn't take this too seriously. Well, maybe. But whether they do have that or not, Jason Spencer has now sent a shot across the bow to anyone who is going to fight to remove Confederate memorials. It cannot be confined simply to a back and forth with one other representative.
I think you're right, and I think it's a great example of you need to be careful where you're saying it and how you're saying it, and conversations on Facebook are not just between friends. And I think a lot of people are going to look at that exchange and see it as something that's inciting an issue at a time when our leaders are saying this is something we need to approach civilly and calmly and be looking for solutions that are positive.
Loretta, how do we deal with something? I mean, Jason Spencer would say, oh, I wasn't being, this was kind of playful back and forth. But it strikes me that says a lot to us about how sometimes, even if we don't mean these things, our insensitivity leads us down a path that is really troubling and offensive to many people.
Right. And it's very difficult within the context of social media to discern inference. So there was no way for anybody reading that to know that they were joking with one another. It really wasn't until Greg wrote his article and put some context around it. So if you were reading it for the first time, you would have no idea that they were, I mean, it was just a back and forth. And my first thought was, these are people, individuals, two individuals who are adults, one, and two, that are leaders within their communities, and ought to be setting examples within their communities for positive ways to engage on what are very sensitive topics. I mean, I think to your point about Dr. King's statue being revealed this week, it was such a poignant moment for a number of reasons. One, I think for Atlanta, where we see a great philanthropic community, business community, population of individuals who understand the civil rights movement because so many people here have lived in it. And it's endemic to who we are here in Atlanta and in Georgia. And then to see something like this come on the heels of that, it really smacks of not only insensitivity and thoughtlessness, but a certain carelessness. And, I was doing a training session actually with some policy folks, a media training, and I was talking about the use of social media and how it's very intentional these days. You have to be very intentional, particularly if you are trying to advocate a point of view and which vehicles are appropriate and which are not. And we're constantly talking to our kids. So when I see, things like this, I think I'm trying to teach my kids, and I know other parents trying to teach their kids to be responsible on social media, be careful what you say, and they're privy to all of this as well.
And by the way, this should not have really caught Jason Spencer by surprise. His brother Jeremy was an associate superintendent with the Georgia Department of Education up until January 2016, after it was uncovered he had made a series of divisive posts on social media about education, about racial issues, about politics, and he lost his six-figure job as a result of it. So these were not sort of foreign debates to Jason after what happened to his brother. And as for Representative Jones, I talked with her briefly yesterday before I posted the story, and she did say, she did not describe this as playful, I'll put it that way. She said, if that had come from anyone else, I would have taken it as a serious threat. She knew Jason Spencer pretty well, but she did say she was concerned by his reaction because, in her words, if that's representative of what people in South Georgia think, then yikes.
All right, so that in itself, all of this is troubling. Of course, the larger issue here is there's no question that in the next session of the legislature, starting in January, there are going to be efforts to, there will be bills introduced flying all over the place in terms of Confederate memorials one way or the other. And one of them, we think is going to be certain to come, is a measure that would overturn a state law which forbids the removal or the movement of the destruction. There's a lot of other language in there that I don't remember off the top of my head. But right now it's against the law for a local community to take action about a Confederate memorial. And Jocelyn, the city of Kennesaw has already said, we want the right to do with our Confederate memorials what we want. I think Decatur is in the same boat. So the larger issue is, again, we unveiled a King statue, and we know we're headed for a session where, once again, race, the Confederacy, our history is going to play a big role.
It absolutely is, and it's going to be so critical that our leaders at the Capitol try to help steer that conversation in a way that's constructive. We know when we see conversations about race, we were all around and saw what happened as we discussed the state flag here. The conversations can so quickly become counterproductive, become negative, become attacks on other groups of people. And I think we've heard from, you know, Speaker Ralston, from Governor Deal, and also from Andy Young recently that, you know, these are issues that need to be in they need to be addressed. There needs to be a conversation. I think there's a lot of agreement amongst leaders around contextualization of our history and an acknowledgement we cannot change our history, but we can put that context around it. You know, Loretta made a great point. You know, we're a state that in large part has thrived because we were a city that handled the civil rights movement appropriately, and we weren't making the same decisions as Birmingham, as so many people often refer to. And very strong leadership, very strong direction is going to be critical to make sure that these issues are addressed, again, in an educational manner, in a constructive manner, and don't just become posturing for the 2018 campaign cycle.
Did you just see something come that you come across you want to tell us about?
As we were talking, we got a long statement from Jason Spencer, sent out to as a press release.
Well, we're glad he's listening.
Yeah. Where he says, it's a quasi-apology. I regret that my choice of words in warning LaDawn about the possibility of violence has been misinterpreted as a threat against her or anyone else who would like to see historic monuments of the Confederacy removed. He goes on to say that the racial division in our nation is terrible and is going to get worse if my colleague and I cannot have the kind of conversation we had on social media and will continue to have face-to-face.
No, that's not an apology.
No.
You can't say I regret.
We need to have these kinds of conversations.
That wasn't a conversation.
Right. And, well, to your point about Kennesaw and local governments and wanting the ability to take down the statues if they so choose. I think, you know, yes, that's one issue. Should there be local control and decision-making around these issues? The other issue is really, who in Georgia is going to step up and take the leadership role in beginning these dialogues and bringing people from different walks and different parts of our community statewide to begin a dialogue and conversation about what we want to do moving forward, because it can't be conducted in a vacuum. We know what happens when conversations take place solely within the confines of the Gold Dome. And we know when they're taking place in different places, but these conversations are being had everywhere. They're being had in churches around Georgia. They're being had in conference rooms. They're being had at the water cooler. So the question becomes then, how do you have a productive dialogue? And I think it's incumbent. I think we've demonstrated in the past that we're a city that can do this. So I look forward to to seeing leaders within the community, pillars of our community, stepping up and beginning this conversation in a positive, responsible manner.
You know, Greg, that's, I think what Loretta says is interesting. And I certainly, he may not want to hear anyone suggest he take on the role she's talking about, Loretta's talking about. Mm-hmm. But one of the most eloquent speeches and moving speeches of the Monday ceremonies was Speaker of the House David Ralston. He spoke very movingly about what this statue means. And he sort of, whether he wanted to or not, he does position himself, as he has in so many other instances where he's tried to tamp down what he would call sort of extremist efforts to pass legislation that he doesn't think is in the interest of the state. He is a guy who seems to understand these issues and talks about them calmly and eloquently.
To me, that was probably the most striking speech of the entire ceremony. He opened it talking about how he was scratching at homework in his bedroom of his LAJ home when he heard on his transistor radio. I mean, you could kind of put yourself there. When Dr. King was assassinated, and goes on to talk about, he had these words about how it's facing, the statue is facing the east as if to welcome a new dawn every single day. They put a lot of time and effort into this. And I do think, my read at least, is that he is game to lead the debate on this. I have a story about it that will be in tomorrow's paper, but his spokesman, his office said that he is looking for a thorough discussion. I don't think that will involve anything with Stone Mountain changes in terms of the faces on the granite wall, but I think it will involve changes that will let local communities have a say in whether or not these memorials should be in their town squares.
All right, I have to get a break in. I want to ask you one more question about this whole episode, and we'll do that after the break and move on to some other big news that we have to discuss today. You're listening to Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Now's your chance to win a beach getaway for two and support GPB at the same time. Your contribution at gpb.org will give our fall fund drive a strong start. You'll also enter to win a St. Simons Island getaway for two at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort, including a three-night oceanfront stay, meals, and golf. No contributions required to enter the drawing, but because you listen, we are counting on your support. That's gpb.org, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Loretta Lepore and Greg Bluestein are here. And so is a new member of our panel, Jocelyn Butler Baker. Teresa Tomlinson, the mayor of Columbus, who's become a regular panelist on this show. She's on at least once a month. She sent out a tweet that I think is worth a couple of minutes of attention. She says, "I was truly taken aback by this," meaning this exchange. "Representative Jones is most gracious in her attempt to understand the threats. Otherwise, his words are worthy of censure." Greg, when Paul Ryan does not criticize President Trump for making a comment that people find offensive in some way, he gets a lot of pushback. The media says, "Where are you? Why aren't you speaking up?" It strikes me that I can't think of many instances in which we have held up our legislative leaders to take a stand, make statements about something like a Jason Spencer says.
You're right, and it's kind of incumbent on us as reporters to do so. I feel like we do that when it comes to what Trump says, but not as much as when it comes to what Georgia lawmakers or Georgia figures say. And we have heard somewhat silence from Republican leaders. We've heard from Stacey Evans and some Democratic leaders in the Democratic Party of Georgia condemning what Jason Spencer said, but the speaker didn't come out with an immediate statement, and some other Republican leaders, most of the gubernatorial candidates, I haven't seen anything from them on this. And so I think it's up to us in those situations to press them for that.
Well, I mean, I think really the only person I've seen come forward to speak in any regard in this context is Stacey Abrams, who initially came out to talk about Stone Mountain and then received response from Ambassador Young, kind of saying maybe that's not the right way to go.
He does, and Governor Barnes too,
does not share her thought on that. More to the point of, you know, let's tell a fuller story rather than telling half the story or removing monuments. Perhaps the better approach is to tell the full story of the civil rights movement from multiple perspectives. And then I think the appointment of Michael Thurman to the Stone Mountain Commission, that may be the direction in
the
which
African-American we go. The African-American CEO of DeKalb County, we
Correct.
Should say. And now the only African-American on that board.
Right. And so, you know, I think that's why I keep kind of coming back to this idea of having a discussion, because we keep shooting from the hip, right? And I think people, there is no quick solve to this. There is no quick decision making to this. This is a process. This is, there's got to be healing. There's got to be dialogue. There's got to be measured responses. And I think that we're going to have as a broader community conversation before we start enacting laws that do certain things and so forth.
Okay, so let's put this in a political context, Jocelyn. You've been involved in lots of campaigns. So we come into the 2018 legislative session. There is no question at this point we're going to see some legislation, unless leadership tries to shut it down, dealing with Confederate monuments. Where do you go as a Republican? Republicans in the legislature are not going to be able, I would think, to have a unified front on what to do. You're going to have some who are going to argue, we've got to preserve our heritage. The lost cause needs to be recognized. Others are going to be in a different place. And is this the sort of issue that could really make Republicans uncomfortable as they approach 2018? Or does everybody simply do what they know their constituents in their highly gerrymandered district want them to do?
I think it's a situation that will make a lot of people very uncomfortable. And I think you'll see, you will have people who will be struggling internally even about what they believe versus what they believe their base constituency wants to hear. I do think this issue will dominate the session in a lot of ways. Again, because we're in an election cycle, what will be interesting to me we'll see how the business community plays in. As you recall, a lot of our more recent change has come because of economic pressures, something that Ambassador Young actually cited this week as well. And Atlanta is a city that relies on global investment, our tourism industry, the convention industry. We've got 3 national level major sporting events coming over the next 3 years. And inappropriate and inflammatory, a highly racial debate over Confederate symbolism does not help our economy. And just like you saw the business community step in on religious liberty, I think this is an issue that they'll need to be engaged with and provide cover to those leaders who do choose to stand up and try to lead this discussion in an appropriate and reasoned way.
Greg, you imagine that what Jocelyn's saying, we're going to really see this cause some difficulties downtown?
I do. I mean, basically because of what we saw from the Facebook feed of Jason Spencer. I think there's a lot of lawmakers who are equally concerned about, even if it is cast as local control, even if it's cast as giving Dahlonega the right to take down a Civil War monument if they want, that it's still going to be a fraught debate. But I do think they'll end up threading that needle. But, of course, this is going to be punctuated by election year politics. There's still going to be we've had a number of resignations over the last few days, at least 3 lawmakers seeking higher office, but you're still going to see many lawmakers looking for a pulpit who will take different stances on this, and this could be a very tough issue in election year for people to deal with.
That's interesting to me, troubling, but interesting. You could have the suggestion that Republicans could be a house divided in dealing with this kind of issue. At the same time, you're going to have the Democratic Party, as we've discussed on this show on numerous occasions now, also divided.
They're just
against
as torn
itself.
They'll
be torn on that, but then you've also got the incredibly troubling racial component of the governor's race between Stacey Abrams and Stacey Evans.
Right. They are running very different campaigns at this point in time and appealing to very different aspects of their party. It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, both on the stump in the legislature, where you see a changing dynamic also within the Democratic caucus in both chambers, the House and the Senate. You have now new leadership in the House with Stacey Abrams stepping out. And so we're going to see a lot of change coming up in the next couple of months.
Let's talk about this notion of people resigning to run for office. We on Monday talked a little bit about some of the people who've already have stepped down. Stacey Abrams has given up her seat so she can concentrate on running for governor Who are some of the others who've already resigned?
Jeff Duncan in the House is running for lieutenant governor.
Lieutenant governor against David Schaefer, and his statement, as you reported, when he stepped down,
He went right after. He named David Schaefer by name. You also have State Senator Hunter Hill, Republican, who represents Buckhead / Smyrna district. Very competitive district. He barely won it last year. Democrats see it as a pickup potential. He stepped down.
Okay, I want to focus on one person who's running for higher office, Secretary of State, who has not made his intentions known. That's Josh McCoon. And I'm wondering, if Josh McCoon steps down, Greg, is the Senate already a Josh McCoon kind of oriented body? Or could this guy, who has been a leader on religious liberty and so many other issues that move really, really to the right, is that going to be a little bit of a, is that going to cool things down at all? Or is the Senate already in his camp?
I can kind of see him going out guns a-blazing. I mean, this past year, he already made it very clear this was going to be, that this would be his last term. But you're starting to see a very significant shift. Jim Galloway, who's on here every Monday and Friday, had a sit-down interview with Lieutenant Governor Cagle, and Cagle wanted the interview to be about broadband, and you know, they talked a little bit of that. But they also talked about the adoption bill. They got kind of caught up in all this religious liberty fervor, and Lieutenant Governor Cagle kind of made it very clear that he was going to try to divorce that issue from the overall adoption bill. So.
Do you know what we're? Do you want to explain that, Jocelyn? How was the adoption bill caught off in right wing politics? I can do it, and Greg, you can weigh it. There was an adoption bill that would have broadened and made it easier to adopt children in a state where there are a lot of children who need homes. It looked like it was headed for passage, and then at the last minute, who was it who introduced the amendment to deny? I don't know either. But an amendment was added to deny gay couples the right to adopt. And it shut the bill down entirely. The governor was furious because he wanted the, because
and Speaker Ralston
and Speaker was,
too.
Ralston
so he had this alliance.
Furious. And so this will come back in the session again this next year because we're in a biennial, so it can be brought back, right?
This will be back. Casinos will be back.
Oh, good.
Civil War debate will be right there front and center. Education funding, the Medicaid waiver issue for health care, now that the federal health care bill doesn't look like it's going to go anywhere. So there's going to be some huge debates that lawmakers are already well underway gearing up for.
All right. I think we're going to have to add an extra hour to every Political Rewind
Probably soon.
All right. We've got a bunch of tweets in. So as we turn to talk about other issues, let me give you feedback on some of them. We have a tweet from Matt Schweitzer who tells us that he thinks contextualization, which you talked about, Jocelyn, is the right way to go in dealing with the historic monuments to the Confederacy. As long as you put them in context, they ought to stay where they are. He says rehashing the Lost Cause myth is nonsense. He's afraid that's what people are going to focus on. Bitter Pill says, Jason Spencer could have made his point without invoking the imagery he thinks of lynching, is how Bitter Pill sees it. Too bad, because he wanted to make a valid point. So we're getting a lot of reaction. By the way, Todd Rehm, our friend Todd Rehm, tweets how glad he is to see that you're doing the show today, Jocelyn.
Well, thank you, Todd.
And he goes on to say, it's take a cheap shot on the way out of the door week. referring
talking about Jeff Duncan.
Yeah,
ouch.
Talking about Jeff
And he also
Duncan.
Says it was probably, he thinks it was Senator Ligon who introduced that amendment.
Yes, right. I think that's right. Yes. Todd did send that out. All right, let's move on. President Trump in Missouri today, let's just touch on this briefly, Greg. He's expected to give a speech today on the tax bill, the tax policy he has settled on. When they get back into session after the summer recess next week after Labor Day, that's a measure that's got to be taken up. The budget, the tax reform bill, got to be taken up pretty quickly. I have two reactions to that. One is was there any surprise that, I mean, this speech has been scheduled for a while, but is this the right night to be giving or afternoon to be giving a speech about tax reform when the country is so focused on Texas?
Yeah, it's tough timing, and I think he's going to continue to get a little bit of criticism over you know, what could be seen as a distracted response. Also, the early reviews of the speech, what little details are coming out, show that there's not that many details. You know, these are all, you know, based on anonymous sources that usually leak these details before the speech so reporters can sort of be ready for what's coming. But they show that there's not a firm number yet on the corporate tax rate. I've seen anything from 25% to 30% it would be reduced to from the 35% level, and the income tax rate. So there's still some questions about how deep these cuts would be. They might just be sort of broader instructions to lawmakers than specifics.
Well, you two are communications experts. Maybe what Greg is saying, if there aren't any details, maybe this is a perfect time for the president to go to Missouri and talk broadly about a tax bill and not be bothered by reporters who are focused on Houston asking him more questions about this.
I think it's tone deaf, and you know, I as I said when we came into the studio, I give the president credit for going to Texas as quickly as he did. But right now is not the time to be talking about policy. Right now is not the time to be fighting about tax reform or budget decisions. There are thousands of people in Houston whose lives will never be the same. There are people who were sent to shelters that the shelters have started to flood. You know, we've got the fourth largest city in the United States underwater, grappling with what tomorrow is going to look like. You know, we're looking at impacts on the energy industry. We're looking at impact on a port. There are huge national issues that I don't think only are the appropriate things for the country's leader to be talking about right now. I think it's what the people of this country want to be hearing about right now. And, you know, others may disagree with me, but I think the time right now is to focus on Texas and those people.
Yeah, I had the same response. And perhaps to this speech in Missouri, we don't know yet. Maybe he will choose to spend more of his time talking Texas. We don't know. But you know what, Loretta? The president, Jocelyn alluded to it, the president went to Texas yesterday. You know, you could argue about the timing, but so what? He went, and as Jocelyn says, many people thought that showed a leadership role that we want from a president of the United States. And it occurred to me as I heard a lot of the criticism about his remarks there, people saying he focused more on himself, talked about the crowd size at one point, talked about the extraordinary response from government people, but didn't talk about victims. All of that is true. At the same time, it led me to this conclusion that, for better or worse, if you don't like President Trump, nothing's going to change. He was going to get criticism no matter what he said. You know, we've really become, we're hardwired now to accept or reject how he behaves in every situation.
Well, I think I think you have a point in the respect that there are folks that are going to support him in everything he does and those that are going to reject him in everything he does. I think we do have those two solid camps. I think there are a lot of Americans who did want to see him go down there, did want to know that the federal government was in charge and responsible in handling this situation to effect. I think his move to bring down the cabinet secretaries to talk about those issues that these victims are going to be encountering from this point forward. I mean, they've already been victimized once, and to ensure that, you know, there are adequate assistance programs in place and people on the ground to help them recover in their homes, to help their businesses be restored, to make sure that they're getting the necessary and vital medical attention that they're going to need. I think all of those things were positives. He had no connection, to my knowledge, with actual victims of this incident.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, that he didn't do that.
Right, and I don't know if that was a matter of trying to stay out of the way, if you looked at some of the logistics of how he did things. But I think a fundamental piece here is that people expect a president to connote a certain tone.
Yeah.
And that tone that was expected was not present. And so that's also part of this problem with this trip that he's taking. There is no question that there are specifics around the tax plan that is being put forward, because Secretary Mnuchin, Economic Council Advisor Gary Cohn, they have spoken to specifics that they are working on to go into this plan. Now is not the time to roll that out.
Well, okay, so let's pick up on that. Greg, Loretta's point is well taken. So the president, he had two meetings in his Texas trip with government officials, emergency responders, and in one location, and then at an emergency call center, I think, and then with emergency officials in another setting. And Lorna's point is interesting. I mean, you don't want to, the president shouldn't plunge into the heart of Houston and be standing on a mm-hmm. on a street corner talking to people who have just been pulled out of the flood. But there were evacuees. And you wonder about the communications staff at the White House that it didn't occur to them that it might have been nice to have added an event in which the president met with people who were no longer in the middle of it where he'd get in the way, but where he could sit and talk with them for 15 minutes about what they had experienced. Yeah. That seems to me not just a failure on the president's part, but a failure on the part of his advance team, his communications office, whatever.
And some of the most compelling tweets and social media stories I've seen were pictures of the last four presidents in these disaster zones meeting with victims and evacuees shortly after the storm when they did visits just like this. It's hard to blame a president for wanting to go down and see it firsthand. But the optics, and especially when he kind of had this like, truck side chat, sort of mini rally almost with some supporters.
Who were standing far at a distance to him,
yeah,
by the way.
You know, it just...
And they were trying. I understand that there are certain privacy concerns and that they are trying to, you know, the Red Cross has said in the Houston Convention Center they're not allowing media past a certain point because this is now these folks' home. It is their home. This is where they're going to be living for a certain amount of time that is unknown. But, you know, I this kind of struck with me that there are many, many more first responders and volunteers that he could have met with. For instance, back during the 2008 election, there was a big storm, and it may have been Katrina. I'm sorry, I'm losing my track of time here. But during the Republican National Convention, and Senator McCain, who was the Republican nominee, refused to have one of the evening's events. So all of us who were there as delegates went out and packed care packages. That's what we did. Mm-hmm. We were bused to centers, warehouses, and we put together care packages. And Senator McCain, Mrs. McCain, they were on site with us. Those are the kinds of things that could have really helped in this instance where you had a personal touch,
Jocelyn,
as part of this trip.
I'm sorry.
No,
Jocelyn,
okay.
What would you have, if you were advancing this trip, what might you have done to show the president's concern about the people?
Well, I guess the first thing would be that I'd assume the president would take my advice, but that's another conversation for another day. But I do think...
Wait. You worked for Zell Miller. go ahead.
Yeah, well, again, another story for another yeah. day. Great honor to work for Governor Miller. Yeah. But, you know, I think there were a lot of, you know, I think one of the things that really struck me, and it is consistent with this president, it was about him. It was about he wanted to go see things firsthand. Wow, there's a big crowd here to see me today. You know, I'm going to do this better than they did for Hurricane Katrina. And I was really shocked at that. Let's talk about how much better we're going to be at this than the Bush administration was during Katrina. Fair point. And hopefully they have learned a ton of lessons from Hurricane Katrina. And hopefully they do handle this better, because there was a lot that certainly could have been improved during that period of time. But, you know, to go down there and be focused on, I wanted this opportunity, when it's not about you. And if it was me, it would have been about interacting with people, hearing firsthand stories, having the chance to say a lot of thank yous and, you know, give either literal or figurative hugs to yeah. the people who are on the front lines and who are affected by this personally.
All right. So it'll be weeks and weeks. The immediate emergency response from government offices seems to have been pretty good from what we can tell. But it's weeks and weeks down the road before we'll really know about all of this. And certainly it's weeks and weeks down the road before Congress is going to be able to get together to pass an emergency relief spending mm-hmm. bill. There's already some controversy about that. You've got several New Yorkers who are reminding the Ted Cruzes of the world that when Sandy hit the East Coast, Ted Cruz tried to block funding and has since created this myth that the reason he and others did was because it was a pork package, which it was not. So here's the question. I throw it out to anybody who wants to pick it up first. How easy will it be to get a big emergency relief bill? And part B of that same question, should you choose to answer it, is, will the president's $1.8 billion in wall funding be a victim of the need to do something about Texas?
It should be easy to pass, but nothing has been easy. And not the wall, I'm talking about the relief funding, but nothing has been easy so far. And I could see that there's a lot of Republican lawmakers who are already very wary of the wall. You've seen that in Georgia. You've seen that elsewhere. So I could see that being used as sort of a, maybe even a pretext, an excuse not to not to support that funding in this go-round.
Well, there's a number of bills that they're going to have to come back and address in a very, very short amount of time. I mean, there's going to have to be some, you know, they've got to get the debt ceiling. They've got to get some budget extensions. They've got this on the table. And, you know, I was listening to Governor Christie this morning talk about funding that came for Hurricane Sandy, and how the funds that were allocated for Hurricane Sandy are still being used today, and they're still in recovery mode to a large extent in New Jersey. But he did make the point that when Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Andrew came through, that the Congress approved those funds within a matter of days.
Yeah.
It was less than 6 days. Well, it took 44 days for funds to be approved for Sandy. And he made the call to his colleagues to say, you know, to his Republican brethren, to say there is absolutely no reason why you all shouldn't be doing this in the first couple of days that you are there.
And I agree. It's a matter of prioritization. And again, you know, getting back to, you're talking about a major city in the United States with people who there's no time to wait. That aid needs to begin immediately. You know, as Loretta said, and I was listening to an interview on the way here, you know, getting people out of shelters into temporary housing is a great example of something that needs to happen sooner than later. And hopefully the right priorities will be set and decisions will be made that will bring the relief that they need there in Houston.
Well, as we go to a break, we should say, Jocelyn, as somebody whose family is a New Orleans family, you know what the folks in coastal Texas are going through right now.
Absolutely. And talking to folks on the anniversary yesterday, you know, they're still recovering down there in every way imaginable in New Orleans. So.
All right. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt, but we do have to get a break in. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the city of Atlanta mayor's race. But let's take a break. This is Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our 30th anniversary retrospective, collecting interviews from our first 2 years. We'll feature interviews with filmmaker Paul Schrader, in which he talked about writing Taxi Driver, and John Updike, recorded after he published Self-Consciousness, his memoir about all the things that made him self-conscious, like his stutter and psoriasis. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Greg, we saw a poll yesterday. Another panelist on Political Rewind frequently, Mark Roundtree, Landmark Communications, is polling for WSB-TV Channel 2 in the mayor's race. I get the fact that the mayor's race affects Metro Atlanta more than it does the rest of the state. Nevertheless, the mayor of Atlanta has a big impact on what happens across the state. So we are going to talk a bit about it as it moves forward. There were some... It was not surprising that Mary Norwood, who came very, very close to winning against Kasim Reed, continues to hold a she's out at about 28%, something like that.
Yeah, she slipped a little bit. She was in the low 30s before, but she still has a commanding lead.
But
she still looks like she's a lock for a runoff spot.
What's the surprise then? There is a surprise.
Well, the surprise is Peter Amon. He's the former COO of the city, and he was at 2, 3% in some of the early polls. He edged up a little bit a few months ago. He's right there in the thick of things. There's three contenders. Remember, this is a ridiculously crowded race. There's eight or nine people who have a feasible shot at this race. But there's sort of a deadlock among three politicians for that second spot in the runoff, and it's Peter Amon, Councilwoman Keisha Lance Bottoms Lance, and Council President Caesar Mitchell. So they're all within the statistical margin of error right there, and Peter Amon has just jumped up. Major.
Yeah, I think people see Peter Amon as a fresh face for Atlanta. And even though he was part of the city government, so he's not completely new to the scene. He's articulate. When you hear him speak, he's got plans for how he wants to carry the city forward. I don't have a dog in the hunt. I'll make that clear. But you know, I've definitely been impressed with what I've heard from him. And again, I think a lot of people see him as not more of the same. If we know we're in a time where people talk a lot about change and talk a lot about change being needed for the future, and I think that could be part of what's contributing to his support.
Well, I think part of his bump came from two of his primary supporters, which are Yolanda Adrian and Claire Mueller. And so if you look at
Make sure people know.
So Yolanda Adrian is currently serving but has announced she will not be seeking re-election for city council.
She represents Buckhead.
She represents half of Buckhead. Howard Shook represents the other half of Buckhead. And she has endorsed Peter Amon. And, you know, Mary Norwood, being a citywide representative, they've, you know, worked together, sat together. But Yolanda's point was, you know, when it comes to the fiduciary responsibility, while Mary has been an excellent representative for the citizens of Atlanta, and particularly in terms of constituent services, that we have a huge transportation initiative underway. There's going to be a tremendous amount of accountability with regard to the funding around new transit projects and running the city. And she put all of her eggs in the Peter Amon basket. And Claire Mueller, a former city council member, also who carries another part of the city, and I'm not really sure her former district, but not Buckhead. I'm pretty sure it was kind of the Morningside area.
Yeah.
She really endorsed him also. So he's been running a lot of ads with their endorsements. And that's big. I mean, that's really big. And he's been also, I saw over the weekend, he had a big meeting with several members of the interfaith community and spent a lot of time talking with them. So he's really working out there, and I'm sure that these numbers are now a reflection of all of the work his campaign has put in.
So there's a big, big headline in these polling numbers, I think, and that is it is conceivable, as we watch this race unfold, there will be a runoff almost certainly, as Greg has already said. We could very well have two white candidates in a runoff for mayor of the city of Atlanta. The last time Atlanta had a white mayor was 44 years ago, Sam Macell, who, by the way, when you want to talk about why the annexation of Emory and CDC has huge political impact, Sam Macell, to some extent, won that race because Buckhead was annexed to the city of Atlanta and added white voters to the voting pool in the city. But just, Greg, two white candidates, it's really a sign of the demographic shifts that are happening in the city limits.
Yeah, and really, again, going back to Mary Norwood, the fascinating thing about her poll numbers is that she is consistently not only winning Republicans and Buckhead voters, but she's the leading, in many of these polls, she's the leading vote getter among African Americans, among people in Southwest Atlanta, Southeast Atlanta, not by much, 23%, 24%, but enough to be the leading vote getter. And whenever I ask folks about what is the appeal for Mary Norwood, they always say she shows up for the years. Mm-hmm. She's been going to pastor appreciation days and parades and festivals all over the city, even when she wasn't running for mayor. And people remember that.
And she's responsive. She's always been responsive.
All right. Well, we're going to watch that race unfold over the weeks ahead. And, you know, at some point, I think what we're going to do is schedule a conversation about that'll help us say, yes, people in Savannah, Macon, Columbus, all the other places where you listen to our show, there are reasons why paying attention to this race makes sense for you. And so we'll do that in the weeks ahead. We're just about out of time, but I didn't want to miss an opportunity to lighten things up a little bit at the end of this show. GPB producer Don Smith came into my office this morning to point out to me that today is the anniversary of the birth of Molly Ivins. You know, one of the great political columnists, one of the great humorists. She was in Texas for virtually her entire career. She took on corruption in Texas government. She was there to watch both Bush H.W. and George W. When they moved into national, when they became president. She covered George W.'s White House run and covered him while he was in the White House. And she was hilarious. And I thought it'd be fun, just for a minute, to play Molly Ivins. She appeared on the David Letterman show a number of years ago. And Letterman asked her whether she thought she was the most loved or most hated newspaper person in Texas.
They do polls every year that to find out who's the best liked and most hated columnist in the area. I'm always both.
Well, that's good. That's the appropriate balance then, isn't it? And what is the state of Texas politics these days? How are things? A lot of scandals? Not so many scandals?
Well, the speaker's under indictment again, but that's normal where we are.
Right.
We did have one, 73-75, who wasn't indicted. He was shot to death by his wife. She wasn't indicted, however.
Molly Ivins would have been, I think, 73 years old if she had lived today. I grew up, I don't know if we all have a humorist, a political humor column. I grew up in Chicago with Mike Ryko, who was perhaps the greatest of the political humorists.
I was always a huge fan of Dave Barry down in
Dave Barry, who's been a guest on on Two Way Street a couple of times. Are there any humor columnists who do politics that you're fond of, Loretta?
You know, I've always followed Mike Lukovic, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm here with the AJC, and, you know, I've moved around quite a bit. So, but he's always poked a lot. When I was at CNN, he always had a great way of poking fun at what we did over there, and did it in such a intellectually stimulating way.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to second Loretta. I always look forward to seeing what Mike's got for us. It's kind of something to look forward to often in the AJC.
May he never retire.
Yeah. All right, we're out of time for today's show. Jocelyn, it's been really a pleasure to have you come back and be on the show with us again.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And Loretta, of course, we liked having you here, Greg Bluestein.
Thank you.
You too. Jocelyn, as long as you're here, I want to promote Friday's show because you'll understand why we're doing it. In the summer of 2015, Jim Galloway and I sat down 2 weeks after the terrible church massacre in Charleston when Nikki Haley was talking about pulling down the flag, the Confederate flag from the state capitol in Columbia. And we talked to Governor Roy Barnes, and we talked in detail about how he was able to remove the Confederate battle emblem from the state flag and the pressures he felt, the opposition he got, and the fact that, of course, in the long run, it was largely responsible for his losing his bid for re-election. And so with all of the controversy, once again, about what we should do with Confederate symbols, we thought that on Friday's show, we should revisit that conversation with your former boss, Governor Roy Barnes. So that'll be on Political Rewind Friday at 3. Tomorrow on Two-Way Street at 2, a conversation with one of the most celebrated magazine essayists in the country, Steve Oney. He's a Georgia boy. He went to the University of Georgia, where Greg Bluestein went. And now he has published a book on 20 of his best profiles of famous people. We're going to talk to him about that tomorrow at 2. We're out of time for today's show. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow for Two-Way Street and Roy Barnes Friday at 3.